It's Central Time. I'm Rob Farage. You're with us on the Ideas Network. Coming up, we'll talk about the intersection of free speech, government, and the private social media companies that have a growing influence on the flow of ideas. First, it's Food Friday. This week, we focus in on an ingredient with a surprising history that's making a big comeback. Love it or hate it, you can't ignore it. It's celery. You might be surprised by how many different ways we can use it. I was. Celery can find its way into breads, soups, beverages, even desserts. Lori Skelton is a WPR classical music host and a Food Friday regular. She's been trying out celery in her cooking this last month. Lori, welcome back to Central Time.
Good to be here.
Well, I mentioned a surprising history of celery. Celery used to be hot stuff, right?
And I think we may be coming back around to that. We'll get to that in a minute. But yes, celery used to be in certain tables, especially in Europe, more expensive than caviar. It was considered very high-end. Celery has been cultivated since antiquity, and it was a very welcome vegetable, herb, whatever you want to call it. Some people call it both, on tables going back to, you know, the Roman feasts. I know when you go through the Taste of Wisconsin cookbook that the hotels in Madison and Milwaukee were having a hard time bringing it in. And then, of course, when they were able to get this very high-end vegetable, a lot of people didn't know what to do with it.
Now, you've been doing your homework on celery, and the image I love the most is you let us know that sometimes when young folk were a-courtin', instead of a bouquet of flowers they might bring...
I have heard that this is an Amish tradition dating back maybe generations, but that rather than flowers, yes, you'd bring celery. I know creamed celery is a traditional dish for an Amish wedding, and I have seen pictures where a bouquet of celery, if you will, is in the middle of the table, although that is the way it was served in high-end restaurants over 100 years ago. Big vase of it, each stalk in water, and guests would take the celery from the center, probably eating it with their fingers. How daring.
Now, I'm not dating happily, but if I were, I would love to bring this tradition to the forefront.
Well, I'm told that it might have had some sort of tie-in with a popular dessert in Michigan. Apparently, here in Wisconsin, we put grated carrots in our Jell-O molds. In Michigan, apparently in Kalamazoo, you put chopped celery in with your Jell-O. I don't think I'm going to try that.
No, me neither. And you were hinting it's making a comeback. Celery is big again?
Well, one of the reasons I was interested in looking at this vegetable is I've always thought of it as it's the afterthought, because it's so cheap, it's so ubiquitous, you don't really pay attention to it. And when I started working on these recipes, in January, grocers were paying $20 a carton for celery. In April, the price had gone up almost $70,
wow,
up to almost, and it's still climbing. Two reasons. One, bad growing season in California. It was too cool. Celery is a crop that needs cool weather, but this was too cool, too rainy. And then apparently the latest juicing craze is celery juice. I am not a doctor. I am not a nutritionist. I am not prepared to prove or disprove something that a non-credentialed author named Anthony Williams is saying, but right now, celery is through the roof price-wise because everybody is juicing it.
Well, now there's good news. We're going to get our own Wisconsin celery before too long. Let's talk about the celery flavor. I think the negatives people think of are it has that kind of astringent flavor and it can get kind of bitter. Can we work around that?
Actually, you can. Know your grower, for one thing. Believe it or not, the darkest green celery is going to be the most bitter. You'd think that something that vibrantly green would have the best taste. That is actually showing that celery was not grown well. Celery needs, as I say, cool conditions, a lot of water, well-drained soil, and really it shouldn't be exposed to sunlight. So good growers will actually blanch it when it's in the ground, not throw it into hot water, but cover the stalks with either newspapers or straw so that sunlight doesn't hit it directly and so that the flavors are bright and green, slightly pungent, but you don't want bitter. If you've got bitter celery, that's a good indication that it's not grown well, and it's probably too old to use just on its own. You're going to want to work with it a little bit.
And how do we work with it then? How can we prepare our celery if we're worried about that taste?
The basic way to handle this is start with butter. Celery loves dairy products, and almost every recipe I encountered said start by working your celery in a fair amount of butter. Whether you go on to braise it in stock or in some kind of alcohol, whether you go on to stir fry it, whether you go on to even use it in a dessert, as we tried, you're going to want to not start with it raw. Raw celery has its place in certainly in salads, certainly when you're making ants on a log for your kids. But even there, you're still going to want to look out for, you know, don't just pawn off the really bitter stuff on your kids, because you might give them a complex like I had for years about eating celery, because I had too many experiences when I was little when it was just too old and too bitter.
It's Food Friday. We're cooking with celery with Lori Skelton. You can join in at 800-642-1234. Are you a celery fan? Are there big celery fans out there? I don't know. Tell me if you are. And do you like to cook with it? Do you grow your own celery? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Okay, I've tried a couple things you made for us, Lori. We'll get to the dessert in just a bit. This thing I liked, a celery bread.
That was a surprise for me, because after going through all of this, start with the butter, start with the butter, start with the butter, I ran across something from the Virtuous Bread blog in London, where you make a very basic bread dough, whole wheat flour, salt, yeast, and water, and then you give it a couple of slow proving at one point 90 minutes and then another hour, and then you make sure you rest it between kneading it. And at one point you fold into it a couple of cups of raw celery and a little bit of raw onion. And I thought, oh, really? But it was amazing. It baked into this lovely boule, and it had a lovely full flavor, but it wasn't overpowering. The crumb was still tender. What the London blog suggested, and what I found, was this is a great bread for strong cheeses. And I went strong. I went brick cheese from Monroe, and it was fantastic.
Yeah, well, and I thought celery and bread, it seems kind of weird. But somebody said, well, what about stuffing? Isn't that just like crumbled up bready stuff with celery in it?
But then again, when you're making stuffing, you've got celery plus probably some other things. Even if you're not putting a lot of protein like sausage or chorizo in your stuffing, it's a good bet that you're using a kind of a stock. Even if it's vegetable stock, that's going to have more vegetables in it. You're never just working with celery on its own.
Okay. Let's bring on a caller. We've got Doug on the line in La Crosse. Doug, hi.
Hi. How are you today?
Good. What do you want to tell us about, Doug?
Well, I am a transplant, just moved up to La Crosse from the Texas Gulf Coast about 5 years ago. Celery is part of the Trinity.
Mm-hmm.
In case your listeners didn't know, Cajun cooking and I believe Creole as well, pretty much anything that you're going to cook in a pot starts with onions, bell peppers, and celery.
And let me guess, twice as much onion as celery and bell pepper, right?
Correct.
Okay, which, of course, that's the Trinity, because it mirrors the classic French Trinity, the mirepoix of twice as much onion to carrot and celery when you're doing almost any stock or sauce. Oh, of course, it's a great base. And one of the reasons I wanted to focus on celery was, yes, I know it works with other things. Where can I find recipes where celery is more of the standout? Mm. But Doug, you're absolutely right. You can't do Cajun. You can't do Creole without your celery in there.
Doug, thanks a lot for that call at 800-642-1234. It's Food Friday. Lori Skelton is with us to cook with celery. We'll hear about some more dishes coming up, and you can join in at 800-642-1234. What is your favorite way to cook and or eat celery? Do you have a recipe to tell us about featuring celery? Do you grow it yourself? Are you doing it this year? We have some to spare for Lori. Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Or post on the Ideas Network Facebook page. Find a recipe we'll talk about in a couple at WPR.org/Food Friday. It's a celery dessert. This is Central Time. You're listening to Central Time on the Ideas Network. I'm Rob Ferret. It's Food Friday. Lori Skelton is with us for a look at the many different ways we can use celery in our cooking. You can join in at 800-642-1234. Is celery a snack for you, or do you use it in your cooking as well? Do you have a favorite dish that uses, maybe features celery? Do you have questions for Lori about how to use it? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Before we go back to our callers, Lori, you brought in a dessert recipe from Lydia Bastianich. She's been she's best known as having been a guest on this show. I understand she does other things as well.
Well, yeah.
all right, maybe not. But candied pears and celery. We've got this at WPR.org/Food Friday.
I didn't believe this the first time I read it. She wrote it up for years ago for Gourmet magazine, and I have the Gourmet cookbook, and I'm reading this. It's like, okay, celery and dessert. That can't possibly happen. But it's Lydia Bastianich.
Right.
She doesn't make mistakes. And sure enough, again, another food blogger mentioned trying it and being delightfully surprised. I brought this in for Wisconsin Public Radio to try, and everybody was surprised. Tastes better than it looks, was the general consensus. Part of my brain won't accept celery as dessert, but it's not bad. The sweet pears with the slight bite of celery, somebody else said, this needs ginger ice cream, and I couldn't agree more. This would be lovely with ginger ice cream, and since it's Lydia Bastianich, if you've ever made Italian olive oil cake, this would be a lovely thing to add to it. Even with the syrup, it's very refreshing. Central Time producer Dean Knetter, I think, had the best comment. Pears have a bright flavor. Celery has a bright flavor, both when they're raw. You roast pears, you lose that brightness. But there's something about the roasting of the celery, it still has that bright green flavor. So you're able to play off the raw versus the cooked in both of these in a way that makes both of them just taste better.
So celery and dessert, it can happen and it can work.
It can. Now, having said this, this is a recipe we've got online, and I must caution you, if you don't normally drink Moscato dessert wine, be very, very careful. There are varying degrees of sweetness, and I picked one that was very, very very sweet. So I cut back on the amount of sugar that I used. I was very happy with the way the dessert turned out, but the actual candied syrupy around the celery was probably not as thick as Lydia Bastianich would want it. So knowing it, when you know how sweet you can handle your wine, play with that. And again, you may come up with something that's not as thick on the celery, but will still taste delicious.
Let's go back to our callers now. Shelley is with us in Madison. Shelley, hi.
Hi. Thank you, Lori and Rob. I love celery. Doug sort of stole my thunder because I could not agree more. I don't know what you can't cook without onions and celery. So I appreciated that. But I love celery raw. I love celery, and sometimes people are like, you're putting celery in that, but I love it. So,
okay.
Thank you. I'm so eager for some of your recipes.
Well, now let me ask, when you're putting things in celery raw, why are you adding it? What is missing in the basic recipe that you think celery is adding the missing ingredient?
Oh, gosh, that's a really good question. My first thought that comes to my mind is kind of that tang. I don't know if that's the right word, but
that's a great word.
The crunch would be that. Yes.
The texture, but also that's a great word, tang.
Mm-hmm.
That you're adding some zip to it, and again, up until just a few months ago, it was zip that came at a relatively low price tag. All the more reason why, if you are going to go out and buy a bunch of celery and only use a couple of stalks in one recipe, you want to make certain you're using the whole thing. So yes, I'm thrilled that we've got all these other options.
Shelley, thanks a lot for the call. We'll go to Marcus in Milwaukee next. Marcus, hello.
Hi. So my cousin Dave's birthday is the 4th of July. And his favorite dessert is strawberry rhubarb pie. Anyways, one year, my grandma actually, partway through making the two pies, she ran out of the strawberry rhubarb to go with the strawberries for the pie, and she actually took and cut up a bit of celery and dispersed it between the two pies, and none of us noticed. She just said that she had to go with some of the neighbor's regular rhubarb because it looked a little more green compared to the strawberry rhubarb, and it was fantastic, and only after both pies had been devoured gratefully did she actually tell us what had occurred.
Wow. And did somebody then make it on purpose with some celery, or was this a one-off?
This was, well, to the best of my knowledge, it was a one-off, but it could have could have been flipped a Mickey on other occasions. I don't know.
Well, considering both celery and rhubarb are stalks, you're definitely dealing with the same kind of cellular structure in the plant. But good for grandma. This is a woman who definitely knows her way around the kitchen and obviously knew how to adjust the seasoning in the pie so that nobody was the wiser.
Thanks for the story, Marcus. Appreciate it at 800-642-1234. It is Food Friday. Lori Skelton is with us. We're cooking with celery. Lori, before I go back to our callers, mentioning rhubarb reminds me of a big thing about celery. That stringiness sometimes is a problem. And, you know, rhubarb can be the same way. What do we do about it?
Celery is pretty easy to deal with. If you're breaking off stalks, you break them off so that you've got that slightly wider piece at the end. Literally, just bend that back and pull. And, again, if your celery is not old and not tough and not bitter, you should get most of the strings just by pulling it back from the end of it. If you notice a few more strings, then go and get your swivel peeler and give it a quick swipe with that. And that's going to take care of most of the strings. But you're absolutely right. The stringiness, if you're not expecting it, if it's not part of the dish, if it's not the texture that we've been talking about, it can be off-putting. So it's worth taking the extra minute to peel it.
All right, back to your calls with no strings attached. Kathleen is with us in Montello. Kathleen, hi.
Hi, how are you?
Good. What did you want to tell us about, Kathleen?
Well, I've been using celery in smoothies way, way back. I didn't even know that it was a fad now. But the thing that I would say is when you use celery in smoothies, you do have to macerate it pretty well. I use a Ninja blender for mine, and I put it with everything in my smoothie, and it adds just a really nice, bright flavor.
Kathleen, thanks for the call. Macerate, I think I've learned from you, Lori, that's when we're mooshing things together with fruity stuff, right? Roughly?
It's a way to do that. Although she was specifically talking about the blender she was using, I think that goes back more to what we were just talking about. You need to make certain whether it's you're using a really good blender or you're taking the strings out beforehand that you don't want that texture in a smoothie.
For sure. Thanks a lot. Enjoy those celery smoothies. Cindy is with us next in Appleton. Cindy, hi.
Hello. Well, two of my favorites, because a good Waldorf salad is made with celery, which I absolutely love, and I love celery with just peanut butter, you know, spread all over it.
You bring up an interesting point, something I didn't know before I started this. Walnuts and peanuts and celery have similar chemical compounds in, which is one of the reasons why they go so well together. Now, peanut butter on celery, yeah, we all had ants on a log when we were kids, but one thing that I had completely forgotten about is that there is that wonderful satay sauce that's usually served on chicken, the peanut sauce.
Like a Thai or Southeast Asian sauce.
Yeah. And depending on how hot you want it, you add more or less chili. It's a thinner sauce. Very often people use it as a dipping sauce. But hot peanut sauce and celery is fantastic. If you don't want to go the whole stir fry route, but you've got some celery and you want to use it up, thin some peanut butter with maybe a little stock, add some chilies, and toss your celery in that. It'll be fantastic.
Thanks for the call, Cindy. Marcus is with us now in Green Bay. Marcus, hi.
Hi. I used to grow celery quite a bit in my garden, and it became too much as far as having to keep it mulched and water it. But I got to where I would always cut the leaf and dry and save the leaf, and I use it in everything. And now I just grow celery and I let it get bushy and I cut it all summer long. I dry the leaf. I use it fresh. A lot of times I'll use it instead of cilantro in salsas and things, especially if people don't like cilantro. But it adds this earthy quality to everything.
You said earlier, Lori,
a celery can be an herb, too.
Exactly. Right. Yeah. And yes, the bread we mentioned before, they suggested that you line your final proving basket with celery leaves so that when you turn the bread out and bake it, the celery leaves are on the top. It looks delicious even before you take a bite.
Time for one more caller. Denise is with us from the Twin Cities on her way through Wisconsin. It sounds like Denise. Hi.
Hi. Yeah, my husband's a chef, and he's also was born and raised in Greece, so we eat a lot of Greek cooking. And one of our favorite dishes, especially in the winter, is chirino meselino, which is braised pork with celery in an egg lemon sauce. It is amazing.
Oh. Avgalamono, of course. Oh, that sounds fantastic. I've had avgalamono as a soup, but never as a sauce for pork. I'm going to have to try this. It sounds incredible.
Fantastic suggestion, Denise. Thanks a lot. Well, celery blew up our phone lines, Lori. One more dish you mentioned. Behind the scenes here, when there's a really successful dish that Lori makes for Food Friday, you know it's good because there's not enough left over to bring in because she ate it all. What was that this time?
Marcella Hazan, another great Italian cook, she makes celery risotto. And you put half your celery in with the onions at the beginning so that they cook. And then you save a little more for towards the end so it still retains, again, that texture, that bright green taste. It's a fantastic side dish for chicken and for duck.
We'll leave it there, Lori. Thanks a lot for joining us again on Food Friday.
Thank you so much.
That's Lori Skelton, WPR classical music host and a Food Friday regular. She was with us today to share some of the many uses for celery. Thanks for all your calls as well. And by the way, you can find the recipe for candied pears and celery that Lori talked about earlier. It's at WPR.org/Food Friday. When it comes to free speech, the internet is kind of like the Wild West. In the early days of the internet, many people saw the online world as a free speech paradise, but there are growing concerns about the ways people are using the internet, including hate speech, harassment, illegal activity, and recruitment for extremist groups. Policing the internet is controversial, especially when governments try to dictate to private companies how to censor speech. On the flip side, allowing social media platforms to become safe havens for people to promote violent hate speech is becoming a concern for many media watchers. This leaves companies and governments in a tight spot, but our next guest says there are ways to thread that needle. David Kaye is a law professor and author of the new book, Speech Police: The Global Struggle to Govern the Internet. David, welcome to Central Time.
My pleasure. Thanks for having me.
Well, you start off talking about a fundamental change in the architecture of the internet, from a dispersed system to a lot more concentration in social media platforms. What has that meant for how speech happens and could be regulated?
Well, over the last decade and a half, we've seen a real concentration in media, particularly through social media, and that's had two impacts, really. One impact is that it's given these massive platforms, in particular YouTube and Facebook and Twitter, the responsibility to evaluate content, to evaluate speech on their platforms. And that's a very serious responsibility. And it's also caused, I think, to many minds, a lot of public harm. And the other part of it is that it has created a kind of one-stop shopping for governments that like to censor. So rather than back in the old days, you know, hunting through the blogosphere for content to restrict, now governments, particularly authoritarian governments, can go directly to the companies and say, take down this content, take down this person, restrict the expression that you're allowing.
And that gets the central conflict in your book. How can a hopefully non-authoritarian government and social system deal with an internet where there are things that cause clear harm being posted, but some sort of free speech rights still should apply?
That's right. I mean, if we think back toward the time when, you know, the internet was just starting out, and even social media was just starting out, you know, it was an opportunity for the democratization of speech, for the ability for people who don't normally have an audience to gain an audience or to connect with others and so forth. And that's been, you know, tremendously advantageous to individuals around the world, particularly activists and organizers and others who are in dissent from governments. But at the same time, we've seen harms develop. And the real issue for democratic governments right now is how do they deal with those harms in a way that doesn't inadvertently give cover to authoritarian governments to do their own kinds of harms, to take action against individuals and the platforms in a way that really restricts expression. That is it's a tricky situation for many, and it's one of the great challenges for the online world today.
Before we get into how we navigate that, can you talk about some of the harms that we've seen from insufficiently regulated use of social media used as a weapon, I guess?
Sure. I mean, there are some very clear harms that I think anybody who's familiar with the news over the last several years would identify. You know, these are harms like the rise of the platform's use for hate speech, for incitement to violence in places as diverse as, well, the United States, Myanmar, Germany. We've seen the increasing abuse of the platforms for purposes of disinformation and election interference. I mean, these are very real harms. But one of the problems with viewing the internet only as a place of harm is that it is giving, you know, all sorts of reason to governments to restrict expression. And one thing I think we ought to be thinking about is not so much in terms of regulating the content of the platforms, but making them much more open and transparent to evaluation. Because one of the clear truths about the current environment is that the public and the government in particular knows very little about what's happening on the platforms, how the platforms are operating, how they're restricting expression, and how they're essentially trying to make their platforms safe for individuals and for the public.
One of the challenges seems to be, and you talk about this in your book, that it can be really hard to set a simple rule. One example, an easy rule might be to say, never show an image of a naked child. But you give an example of Kim Phuc Phan Thai, who was the young Vietnamese girl in that famous Napalm Girl picture from Vietnam. We have that picture up on our Facebook page now because I just talked to her on Friday. How hard is it to establish rules when there are notable exceptions?
Yeah, it's extremely hard. I mean, this is one of the key problems of actually regulating content today. So one of the issues is where do we draw the rules and how do we draw the rules? You know, when the platforms were more competitive and they were smaller, I think that most people in the public, and this is true around the world, I think, would have been fine with saying, okay, you know, each platform can be different and they can draw the rules wherever they want. And if they don't want to allow the picture of, you know, so-called Napalm Girl on their site, that's fine. The problem is that the platforms have become such massive platforms for media and for many places around the world, such major sites for public information, that the old way of thinking about the platforms, you know, purely as private actors is really in a way outdated. And so the drawing of those lines has become less a question about where exactly to draw those lines and more about who should be drawing those lines. Should it be government or should it be the platforms? And that's a discussion that we in the United States have really hardly begun to address, while many people around the world are very deep into that particular debate.
David Kaye is with us. We're talking about his new book, Speech Police, The Global Struggle to Govern the Internet. David, what conversation should we be having in the United States about that question you just raised? Who should be setting these rules?
Well, I think the first question for Americans and really for the political class, let's say, is to move away from the kind of partisan way of thinking about the platforms and to think more broadly about how to really protect the original promise of the internet and how to deal with the harms that are caused online today without undermining that original promise. I think we need to step back from the, you know, the questions of, you know, are conservative voices sort of undermined while liberal voices are preferenced. That's actually very little of what's happening online. And I think it would be very important for us to have a, you know, have a coherent conversation in the United States, one about, you know, issues of whether the platforms are too big, and that's a conversation that has started. But the other question really has to be, what does it mean to regulate the platforms in this new, I mean, still new digital age? What does it mean to say that the companies have public impact, and what does that mean for the kind of regulatory approaches, particularly in a First Amendment friendly environment, that we should be addressing? And we're hardly having that conversation in this country right now.
You also write that you ought to see human rights at the center of the discussion of how our social media-dominated internet works. What do you mean by that?
That's right. I think it's really important for us as Americans to really realize and to accept that the platforms are global. They're not just platforms for Americans to have conversations. When you think about Facebook, for example, 85%, at least 85% of its user base is outside the United States. And the way they think outside the United States, generally speaking, about free speech issues is not through the language of the First Amendment, but is through the language of human rights law. And there actually is human rights law on freedom of expression that is highly protective of freedom of expression. There's a real jurisprudence around free speech around the world. And my view is that in order for the platforms really to speak to that global audience and to speak even to governments that want to restrict expression, that the company should be speaking in the language of human rights rather than either the First Amendment, which, you know, they're all kind of marinated in that culture, in our culture, but also speak in the context of, you know, the harms that are caused and the way in which individual freedoms can be preserved.
Finally, I want to talk about the practical ways that whoever's in charge can police what's going on, whether it's a government or a community group or a platform. YouTube, you write, gets hundreds of hours of uploads every minute with the sheer volume of things. Is it possible, is it feasible to really keep up with what's going on?
That's a great question. I mean, we are facing, and the platforms in particular are facing, a real tidal wave of information that's on their platforms, and it's extremely difficult for them to evaluate all of that content. You know, most of them are moving towards using artificial intelligence, you know, algorithmic decision making, in order to at least perform a kind of filtering of the information that they don't want to see on their platform. Oftentimes that goes to humans, human moderators, and there are tens of thousands in this new industry of content moderation, people around the world that are handling this. But at the end of the day, you know, the platforms will be the first responders, and governments still need to ensure that individuals within their jurisdictions are protected. And I think that first and foremost, that really does mean opening up the platforms to public oversight, to public information, to sharing information and research about what's happening on the platforms so that governments can take really smart regulatory steps, not steps that interfere with the free speech rights of individuals, but really takes care to protect the public and protect individuals and their right to freedom of expression on the platforms.
David, we'll leave it there. Thanks so much for joining us today.
Thank you so much for having me.
David Kaye is a UC Irvine law professor and author of the book Speech Police: The Global Struggle to Govern the Internet. The Wisconsin Supreme Court sided with Republican state lawmakers today, upholding laws that limit the governor's powers. Those laws were passed in December during the legislature's lame duck session and were challenged in court for being unconstitutional. They've got multiple court challenges. The justices voted 4-3 in support of the lame duck laws. The majority opinion, written by conservative Justice Rebecca Bradley, states, quote, "The Wisconsin Constitution itself affords the legislature absolute discretion to determine the rules of its own proceedings," end quote. Sean Johnson joins us now. He's Capitol Bureau Chief for Wisconsin Public Radio. Sean, welcome back.
Hey, Rob.
So we've talked about this before a lot.
There's
multiple cases here. This is the one that didn't have anything to do with the merits of what the laws did, right?
This was the clean procedural challenge by the League of Women Voters. It said that everything that happened in the extraordinary session was unlawful because the Wisconsin Constitution does not let legislators meet in extraordinary session. So an extraordinary session is called by legislative leaders. The Wisconsin Constitution does not explicitly spell that out anywhere. It says you can have regular sessions, you can have special sessions, which are called by the governors, but didn't say anything about extraordinary session. That was their argument. The majority in the Supreme Court did not agree with that, and they dismissed this case.
All right, we're 6 months into this thing or so now. Sean, remind us of some of the key things that happened in this lame duck session.
I think a lot of the stuff that people have probably latched onto is that this lame duck session limited the powers of the incoming Democratic governor, Tony Evers, and the incoming Democratic attorney general, Josh Call. One thing we've talked a lot about is it prevented them from leaving the federal lawsuit against Obamacare, against the Affordable Care Act. They used this ruling, actually, in the window that it created when it initially struck these laws down to get out of that case. But that was one of the powers that they lost in that session. Also, the session prevented Evers from rescinding some Walker-era waivers on things like work requirements for food stamps, Medicaid. Those were powers that he would have had before the lame duck session. It took them away. And you know, I guess it limited his powers in a variety of other ways, some of them easier to explain than others.
Now, here's where it got kind of weird. As you mentioned, this went up through the court system, as things do usually before they go to the state Supreme Court. Some judges agreed with the plaintiffs here, says, you're right, these laws never happened. And then we went back and forth between parts of that being waived, parts of it not. And under those waivers, the governor, as you were saying, used some of these powers that now, after the Supreme Court ruling, he doesn't have.
Yeah, there was, think of it like a window, I guess. There was a window that was open briefly. It has now been shut by the state Supreme Court in this case. That doesn't mean that they're going to go back and undo things, that undo everything that happened while that window was open. But because of this ruling today, most of the laws that were passed in the lame duck session, most but not all, have been upheld.
Now, we've got the Supreme Court. We have nonpartisan elections. There aren't Democrats and Republicans, but there's a conservative and liberal group as we usually evaluate it. How did this particular vote break down?
Pretty much exactly the way everybody was predicting. I mean, I think there was some question over who would write the majority opinion. Given what you heard in oral arguments, it sounded like Justice Rebecca Bradley and Justice Dan Kelly had some serious concerns with this lawsuit. They basically said so from the bench. And it was Justice Rebecca Bradley who wrote the opinion. And her point that she drove home is that the legislature has broad authority to decide its own process. And if whether it wants to call a session extraordinary or not, it's their call to make and not the court's.
And at no point in this particular case is the argument about what the laws themselves did, whether they were appropriate, right? It's all about the procedure.
Not in this case, correct. So there is, though, a second case that is still before the state Supreme Court, that one brought by Service Employees International Union, among other unions, and it challenges the merits of the law. It's making a separation of powers argument, saying that the legislature took too much power constitutionally from the governor and from the attorney general, statewide elected constitutional offices. And they're saying that they went too far there. So the court has not weighed in on that yet. This was just a process argument of how the legislature got there.
Talking to WPR's Sean Johnson about a ruling from the state Supreme Court on challenges to a lame duck session of the legislature back in December. Sean, in that case you just mentioned on the merits, theoretically, I mean, the executive did sign off on that. Governor Scott Walker, kind of on his way out the door, signed these changes that would affect his successor. Mm-hmm. Neither of us is a lawyer, but that might, I imagine, be used as an argument to justify its passage and its constitutionality.
I think when this case gets to the court, when they have a chance to hear arguments, which they haven't yet, and they have a chance to rule on it, the realities that existed for this case in terms of the breakdown of the court will be the same. I mean, you've got this majority 4-3. Actually, you know, in August we're going to have a 5-2 majority. So
after Shirley Abramson leaves, Brian Hagedorn is sworn in.
Yeah. So I mean, those realities still exist. The arguments that we're going to be talking about in terms of separation of powers are different than whether the legislature can meet in extraordinary session. But an uphill battle for plaintiffs, for sure.
This is all in our state court system. At some point, I dimly remember, Sean, there were two challenges in the federal court system. Am I right?
Correct. And I think one thing that people should remember is that even with this state Supreme Court ruling that said that the December session was lawful, there is still a federal court ruling that is in effect that struck down a provision that was passed in the lame duck session. And that provision put limits on early voting in Wisconsin. So those limits have still been struck down by a federal judge. That federal judge's ruling is still in place. That case is still being appealed. It's still before the Seventh Circuit Court of Appeals in Chicago, and we don't know what's going to happen there. But that the state Supreme Court's ruling didn't change that. The federal court ruling in that stands right now. Mm-hmm. Then there's another federal case, and that challenges the whole session. It's making a constitutional argument, a U.S. constitutional argument, that that Republicans, when they passed these laws, they violated the Republican form of government. Mm-hmm. And by Republican,
not
I don't mean
party,
like Republican
but the,
Party, but
right.
I mean like the people get to choose their own elected officials, mm-hmm. the majority rules.
So the argument there would be kind of a bait and switch. People voted for the governor and attorney general in theory to have their currently existing set of powers. The plaintiffs would be saying, ah, but then before they took office, you changed that. They would argue you pulled the rug out from under voters.
Right. Yeah. They're arguing that people had a certain expectation when they voted for Tony Evers and Josh Call, and that what they got is a governor and an attorney general that had less power than they expected.
Now, that often our state Supreme Court, we can kind of predict what they're probably going to do. Federal court system, it's a whole different ballgame. It could depend on which judges, which panel is appointed within an appeals court, that kind of thing.
Yeah, and this is before a district court right now, a district court judge. So you're looking at one judge. It's the same judge who put a hold on the early voting restrictions. So there's one tea leaf you maybe could read. But that judge decided not to have arguments in this case. So he's just going to issue a ruling based on the briefs. I'm not sure where he's going to go. And wherever he goes, then it goes to the Seventh Circuit Court of Appeals. And you could get a different mix of three judges that handle the case, depending on kind of like the luck of the draw in that situation.
Do we have any kind of timeline on when that one is supposed to be handed down?
I don't know. I'm just kind of watching. And I don't think there's an immediate deadline that we're watching right now. I mean, they've been briefing the judge in the case, but I'm not sure at this point when he's expected to issue an order.
Now, you followed the partisan gerrymandering issue all the way up to the U.S. Supreme Court, and then it was handed back down, and that's kind of in limbo now, while other similar cases are out there. These issues, I don't know, it doesn't seem like they're the sort of thing that necessarily the U.S. Supreme Court is going to want to tackle, unless it was happening in a lot of states at the same time.
Yeah, I mean, well, it did happen in different states where you saw in this past election that Republicans in a couple states, Wisconsin, North Carolina, did restrict Democrats who were coming into power after the 2018 elections. But I don't know that the cases or the powers that were taken away are similar enough to where you could have them all go up to the court at once. In fact, I haven't heard anybody say that would happen.
Sean, thanks a lot for untangling this for us yet again.
Thanks, Rob.
That's Sean Johnson, Capitol Bureau Chief for Wisconsin Public Radio News. He joined us today to talk about the state Supreme Court's decision that will uphold laws curtailing the governor's powers during last year's lame duck legislative session. Plaintiffs had wanted to, in effect, erase that session on procedural grounds. The Supreme Court, in a 4-3 vote, said, nope, it stands. But there's one more state case out there, and as Sean was telling us, two federal court cases related to that lame duck session. We'll keep following those as we get more developments on them. If you've been online over the last day or so, you may have seen a headline that said something like this: cell phones are making teenagers grow horns. Just as a point of clarification, cell phones are not making anyone grow horns. Here's the deal, as reported by a growing number of media outlets who debunked this viral story. Australian researchers x-rayed a bunch of people in studies in 2016 and 2018. They found that some of them had a thing on the base of their skull called an enlarged external occipital protuberance, or EEOP. Yeah, you know me. It's not a super unusual thing to have. These could be 10 to 30 millimeters. I looked it up. That's like less than half an inch to an inch-ish. Not exactly what you'd think of as a horn. Their surprise was that younger people in the study were more likely to have these things, and the researchers then speculated that, hey, maybe cell phone use could lead to bad posture, which can lead to this kind of little weird bone growth. That's just as a maybe. Their study didn't actually ask participants how much they use phones or any other technology. So file that study away until this month when the BBC cited it in a piece on technology and health. Then some web sources saw it. They know a good headline when they see one, and they ran with the cell phones cause horns story. There is a good takeaway, though. People who've been interviewed about this who know about posture and bone growth say if you use a lot of technology, the computers, the phones, whatever, take breaks. Stretch, be mindful of your posture, and you're going to be healthier. So some good news from a bad headline. This is Central Time on the Ideas Network.